Welcome back to American Scene, the show where we talk about movies with American in the title and what they have to say about American identity, culture, and values. My name is Ben Rosen.
I'm Alan Austin.
This week we are taking a look back while we're on hiatus, taking a little break, lots of things happening in our lives, taking a bit of a summer break, but in the meantime wanted to give you a look back at a few movies that we talked about earlier in the year, starting with a fun little one, American Outlaws.
Yes, this was, okay, so the first note I have on American Outlaws in general is the reception Colin Farrell has gotten on our Instagram page. It is outer-worldly, okay? Let me pull up right now. So, you know, I try periodically to put out a couple, like, retroactive posts, like, hey, go check out this episode we did on this movie, blah, blah, blah. And for American Outlaws, the Colin Farrell, okay, 194 likes is our record now for a post just saying, go back and listen to our American Outlaws starring Colin Farrell. And the comments are just like gushing over Colin Farrell. It's unbelievable, including this one comment. So sweet, gorgeous, and wonderful, and beautiful angel Scott, and the most beautiful smile. So I assume, obviously, Scott Kahn is being referenced here. And my gosh, so the Colin Farrell effect is real, and it's earned in this movie. Like, he is so delightful. And in a movie that's not particularly memorable, in my opinion, he stands out as the best part. And it's just from his natural chemistry on screen. And of course, this is a foreign actor playing an American figure in Jesse James. So, you know, my big takeaway is the Colin Farrell effect. And our other post for our original episode reveal of American Outlaws, 129 likes. So the Colin Farrell effect is both real on screen and in our social media presence on Instagram.
Yeah, when you started telling me that that post was picking up steam, I was kind of taken aback. Like just a hashtag of Colin Farrell gets the people going. You know, it's not like we even tagged his profile or anything. I doubt he's on Instagram, but let's look at, I mean, where this all started for him in the early 2000s. Like, we're going to ignore Ordinary Decent Criminal, starring fellow American Scene actor Kevin Spacey with just an absolutely terrible Irish accent. Have you ever seen this movie? Do you know this movie?
Never heard of it.
So the same character was portrayed in a movie. I can't remember who directed it. I believe it was the guy who did Deliverance, starring John Voight and Brendan Gleeson. Brendan Gleeson played the same character as Kevin Spacey plays in Ordinary Decent Criminal. The General is a good movie. I think I watched about 20, 25 minutes of Ordinary Decent Criminal once upon a time. I couldn't get through it. So that's not a knock on Colin Farrell. I think just Kevin Spacey's accent work is its own minisode, I think, over the years.
I have to think of a more, like, I can't recall other than, because I never watched House of Cards, but I've seen enough to know his accent in that film or in that series. So I imagine that, like, if that's, like, the standard, if it's worse than that, yikes.
Well, he's doing an Irish accent. I'm like, come on, that's a tough one for an American actor. We're not digging into Kevin Spacey here. We're digging into Colin Farrell's early 2000s. So,
But just to say that House of Cards accent, albeit a little corny, very memorable, very, very distinct.
Yeah, and he's making it more memorable by continuing to do the voice in those creepy, cryptic, holiday messages. So it starts with Tigerland. That's where it all starts. And I remember even hearing about Colin Farrell, I guess, in the mid to late 2000s when I started to get more into film. They were like, he really came up in that Joel Schumacher film, which is pretty well reviewed. He also does American Outlaws in 2001, and then Heart's War from Primal Fear director Gregory Hoblit with Bruce Willis in 2002, Minority Report in 2002, huge, Phone Booth in 2002, just a banner year for him. That's basically a one-man show, Phone Booth, and that's a $13 million budget that made almost $100 million worldwide. So, like, boom, bankable movie star. Then he stars opposite one of the biggest actors on the planet in The Recruit, opposite Al Pacino. Like, everything's looking good for this guy.
And to be honest, you know, especially when we were younger, I know I used to, like, hate the pretty boy types. I told the famous story. Did I tell it on this podcast about the Timberlake poster in the locker?
Yes, it was in the same. I think it was in the American Outlaws episode.
Was it?
Yeah, I'm pretty sure.
Yeah. So this guy he's a rock star. Like, he's awesome. He's a super talented actor. And this run of films, while the films may not always be like A+ Oscar worthy efforts, they're all solid showcases for him. A lot of smart choices, mixes it up with the comic book movies, which hadn't yet taken off really in the early 2000s, the way they are considered now. That action, suspense, war, like really good choices for an actor at that point in his career, especially trying to make it in America. Solid, solid agent and management teams behind this guy. Kudos to the whole team.
Yeah, the mid-2000s are where things start to fall off for him, and he starts to make... So he has Daredevil and SWAT, which are both kind of bombs, but thankfully, SWAT's an ensemble. Daredevil, he plays the villain, and I thought actually really fun. That's a movie I saw in theaters and really liked it at the time. I was 13 or 14, so like, duh. And then he does some more like indie-driven stuff, Cillian Murphy and Kelly MacDonald in a movie directed by John Crowley, who'd go on to do Brooklyn, A Home at the End of the World, again, big ensemble cast, The New World, which I've seen and I don't remember him. It's a Terrence Malick movie, so like, did he have any lines? I have no idea. and then he does Alexander and Miami Vice, I think in 2005 and 2006, both massive budget movies that just completely tanked, and those are like on his shoulders.
Well, I think he gets a little bit of a pass for Alexander because the story, the narrative quickly became Oliver Stone got in over his head, tried to do too much. The movie was 9 months long to watch. It was a mess. And I kind of think now in retrospect, he's kind of off the hook. Miami Vice, I just think was received poorly because when people thought Miami Vice at the time, they thought, you know, the pastel suits, the Don Johnson, the corniness yet action. And this movie was very serious. Like this movie did not have much humor at all. And it was just a miss. Two misses in that year. And that other movie in 2006, Ask the Dust, I've never heard of.
Never heard of it, but from an Oscar-winning writer, Robert Towne, I'm just like, how did this make more noise at the time and then kind of just quickly fade away once people saw it? Had never heard of it.
For that time period, for me as a movie fan, if I didn't hear of it then, it must have been really under the radar. Like nowadays in 2021, way easier for me to miss something. There's a million platforms, indie movies, straight to, you know, there's so many ways. I can't tell you how many John Travolta and Nicolas Cage movies have come out in the last 10 years because they all go straight to a platform. There's got to be like 50 combined. There's so many movies. But in 2006, if I didn't catch it then, that's saying something.
Yeah, by 2007, I was making lists in my dorm of like all the upcoming fall releases. I'm like, this is going to be nominated. This is going to be nominated. Probably like these are the movies that I'm going to be, talking about come Oscar season. A movie that literally no one has heard of probably, and basically no one remembers, let alone likes, except for me and Alex Kellerman, is Cassandra's Dream, a Woody Allen movie.
Oh, I love Cassandra's Dream.
Do you really?
I love Cassandra's Dream. I thought it was one of the better Woody Allen dramas. And
fantastic. Yeah, I'm on the same page with you. That's great to hear. That's shout out to Alex Kellerman. We got another one.
I remember really digging not the twist, but the direction the movie went as it kept going. Because it's kind of a twist, but it's also not. It's more of like a bold choice. And I was digging it. And I remember really loving the three main. I think it was Ewan McGregor, Colin Farrell, is it Tom Wilkinson?
Tom Wilkinson, right after Michael Clayton, yeah.
They all nailed it. I think it's a really solid drama in that Match Point vein for Woody Allen's career. I know the reviews at the time and its legacy isn't well regarded, but I'm a huge fan of Cassandra's Dream. Awesome title of a movie also.
Wonderful. Yeah, man. Family is family, blood is blood. God, I just want Tom Wilkinson saying that in my ear. It's great. It's so good.
Yeah.
And then he resurfaces with In Bruges in 2008, and you're like, he's back. He's back. Like his finest work wins the Golden Globe, chewing gum in his acceptance speech, of course. And he's made really good decisions since. I mean, starring in a couple of Yorgos Lanthimos movies. I think he's continues to make more interesting decisions as he's gotten older.
And a lot of odd, like, supporting roles. You think of Horrible Bosses, which, spoiler alert at this point, he gets killed off relatively early, like, in that movie. He was just there to kind of, I think it was the time when Tom Cruise was taking Tropic Thunder, and, like, all these, like, big-time people were taking these kind of goofy one-offs, and I think he saw that opportunity and took it, and I'm glad he did, because when I saw it, my jaw dropped at such a simple performance, but the right makeup, the right costuming, and I thought it was a great choice.
I can't get any privacy or anything.
Hey, Margie. Bobby.
What?
Is your stomach okay? You seem to be spending more time on the toilet than you do at your desk.
I didn't realize I had to tell you every time I want to take a dump.
And if the worst thing about this job is having to tolerate my boss's dipshit cokehead son, well, it's a small price to pay.
You need me to tell you when I'm going to go pee-pee?
I'm just trying to get you to do your part, son. It's not easy times, you know.
I do my part. I do other people's parts. But it doesn't matter to you, because you just want to ride my ass because I'm your son. You know what? I don't hear you giving dick skin any shit.
Dick skin. Nice.
Kiss ass.
Come on.
Yeah, go on. In you go. Go on, gay boy.
I'm not gay.
Please.
I'm not.
I've seen gay boys.
Yeah?
You're one of them.
Where'd you see them?
At your house. Get in the fucking... I'm a green belt, motherfucker.
What?
Yeah.
I think any time, like, a well-regarded pretty boy star decides to play a douchebag and just completely ham it up, I'm like, fuck yeah.
Yeah.
Like, really lean into just how douchey somebody can be. And was he Kevin Spacey's son in the movie?
No.
But that was the first horrible.
Donald Sutherland's.
Oh, I see. Donald Sutherland. Here, there's another actor that we will talk about on American Scene at some point in a couple movies. Past 20 years, basically just playing people's dads.
Like, they should call him Daddle Sutherland.
Oh, gosh.
It's or Donald Fatherland.
There it is. That's exactly what I was going for. It's exact. Took the words right out of my mouth.
Yeah, if you saw The Undoing, that's like Donald Sutherland now to me. Like,
again, like, not something I've seen, but it's always, yeah, it's
oh, you know exactly what I'm talking about without having seen it. So
yeah,
but just to, like, fast forward a little bit, The Lobster, True Detective, which, awful season, he's to me the best part of that season. So another, you know, kind of feather in his cap. It was just a mess of a show. And then really, really, like, smaller parts, and he's great in The Gentleman. Like, it's these fun roles, and he's really taking his career in an interesting place, because at any point he could still play the father lead type role, he could play the leading man, but he could also play a goofy side character or a bit part. That's range. He's one of my favorite actors working today.
Yeah, kind of going that, like, Brad Pitt route of, I can be the leading man, but I can also be the goofy supporting character, or be, you know, just kind of be charming and be there without, you know, playing up the gravitas. Brad Pitt, another mid-2000s war epic movie in with Troy in the vein of Alexander, which is probably why Colin Farrell wanted to do Alexander, since Troy made so much money, nominated for Oscars and all that.
I'm very interested to see his portrayal of Penguin in the upcoming Batman movie.
That's right.
So
that's right.
That's all I got for American Outlaws, personally.
Well,
like,
wait.
Go if you want to talk about anything else.
Yeah, well, the thing that we mentioned in the episode that we said we were going to bring up is, what the fuck is Kathy Bates doing in this movie?
Oh, yes! Sorry for the loudness. Okay, let's recap that.
Sorry. What? Like, shows up playing the traditional religious matriarch, you know, somebody says something about her, I heard that, you know, and I do like the scene that she has where she's on the front porch and she, like, prays to the Lord and is like, the Lord tells you to get the fuck off my property kind of thing, like, get off my lawn kind of moment from her. That's a nice turn, I think, but, like, we didn't need Oscar winner Kathy Bates to be doing this role.
I'm trying to think of, like, what she was doing in that time period.
Yeah, I wrote down, this is 4 years after she played a major supporting role in the biggest movie of all time, Titanic. Like, okay, so there's that. 3 years after Mike Nichols' Primary Colors, which, like, I guess I haven't seen it, but lesser Mike Nichols, nominated for a few Oscars, but she's in that. Also The Waterboy that same year. Like, so just well-regarded, you know, maternal, fun character that she can play. And 1 year before she gets nominated again for About Schmidt opposite Jack Nicholson. And I'm like, here's this nothing of a role, and you're going to give it to an Oscar-winning actress. It's just, the script's not that good. Like, there's really nothing there for her.
The only rationale I could think of is that they needed names because Colin Farrell had not yet become a household name, and they overpaid to get her on there. That's, like, gotta be what it is because, you know, she did make Rat Race as the uncredited squirrel lady, it says on IMDb. But this is a part that, like, a Conchata Farrell should have and would have played on a normal day, like not Kathy Bates. So my thinking is for the trailer, for the posters, for the
publicity
media
campaign days. Yeah,
right. Yeah, you got to send out a name. Kathy Bates is someone you could send on Jay Leno. You could send on David Letterman because no one knows who, even though he's the pretty boy, Colin Farrell is at this point. So because there's other than Kathy Bates, you're not going to send Timothy Dalton out on a media blitz. So it had to be that. That had to be the reason. They overpaid for Kathy Bates to come in and show her face and be part of the team.
I guess. Yeah. It's like, I don't mind her showing up in bit roles, and I haven't seen Rat Race, but if she's barely in it, I'm like, okay, do a cameo or be like a major supporting role in something of quality, like About Schmidt or even something fun like The Waterboy. But to show up and do a supporting role in something that's not that great, I'm like, she didn't have to do this. That's all I'm saying. It was like,
no.
She decided to do this, and I'm like,
yeah,
why?
Yeah,
I don't know.
Yeah.
Should we ask her? Should we call
and,
her up?
Yeah, you know, I think, and this is only allegedly, I think she used the money from this movie to open her own motel,
God.
Which of course is named the Kathy Cottage.
Yeah, it's an Airbnb. It's an Airbnb. Obviously, there's a hot tub.
Yes. Yeah, a couple holes in the wall that you kind of want to watch out for. Because it's Psycho.
Oh, no, the hot tub, I was saying, because of About Schmidt. Isn't she in the hot tub and she's naked?
Yeah.
Gotcha. That's the thread I was going on. I had already come off the Bates Motel thing.
Anyway, yeah, Kathy Bates, I don't know. I also don't know what Timothy Dalton's doing in this movie.
Hamming it up. Hamming it up. I mean, Timothy Dalton's never won an Oscar, you know, so like
nobody was James Bond.
Maybe he thought he was going to. Maybe he thought this was going to be his Sean Connery, the Untouchables turn, you know?
Well, if you have a death scene like Sean Connery, you should win an Oscar for that alone. So he did not have that here in American Outlaws.
Yeah, if only there was an American Outlaws 2, because he lets him go at the end of the movie.
He could be around. Maybe, and he'd be helpful in the second one. He'd be like his friend.
Yeah. Helping him get out of trouble with, I don't know, a rival gang.
Robert Ford.
Oh, yeah. Sure. Oh, and one last thing before we move on to talk about American Violet. One thing that I meant to mention on the episode, but opening weekend for American Outlaws opened in eighth place. So not great, but do you know what was seven spots ahead?
At number one?
American Pie 2.
Ooh! American Showdown.
Yeah, which, you know, probably my least favorite American Pie movie of the ones released
Reunion,
in theaters.
Reunion was probably my least favorite.
Yeah, I revisited that one with another shout out to Alex Kellerman earlier this year. And I'm like, these guys are supposed to be my age in this movie. Like, they're supposed to be like in their early 30s and they have not grown up at all.
Not only that, they in real life, they're like in their close to 40s.
Yeah, these are they get into shenanigans in American Reunion where I'm like, no, even like remotely sensible 30-year-old is doing this.
Yeah, my favorite line from Scary Movie 1, well, one of many, I'm a huge fan of Scary Movie 1, is when they're talking about how they think they're in a horror movie and they're like, we're not in a horror movie because if we were, they'd cast people in their late 20s, early 30s to play us, and they're all in their late 20s, early 30s. Love that. Love self-awareness in early 2000s spoof movies.
Yeah, for sure. Moving on to something a little bit more serious, American Violet, which I loved the conversation that I got to have with Carrie Blakinger. That was wonderful. And I think it's also worth mentioning that, so originally we were going to drop American Ultra on 420 because we assumed that it was going to be a stoner movie. I don't think it's a stoner movie, having watched it a few times for the episode. But the episode that we ended up releasing on 420 was American Violet. Worth mentioning that the episode happened to drop the day that Derek Chauvin was convicted. So just an interesting to have had that conversation with Carrie about criminal justice and a movie that really centers on racial profiling on the day where we happen to get a bit of news that isn't necessarily justice or a real, you know, a bigger step in the right direction, but it is meaningful.
I think at the very least, it points out that it's still a relevant conversation. It's still a relevant problem. Nothing's been cured. The conversations are still happening and bigger steps still need to be taken. So it's a constantly evolving kind of thing. And the conversation's far from over. And, you know, my biggest takeaway with this movie is, and we talk about it in American Beauty, and that's the much different world that is post 9/11. I feel like this movie made today is also a lot different the way American Beauty would, because as much as we liked American Violet, it's still relatively simple, I guess. It almost seems like just a formulaic, important movie more so than anything really groundbreaking. And I think if the same movie's made today, it's going to have more of a Fruitvale Station kind of importance feel, as opposed to just Getting Lost in the Shuffle in 2005 or whenever it came out.
Right. Yeah, I think if made today, there would be more layers to the movie than what we saw. And I don't think it would necessarily end with that same kind of postscript. Like, yes, it's mixed in the, as we talked about, with what the postscript says, but that feeling like, oh, things are kind of moving in a hopeful direction. Like, I don't get that sense right now, you know?
Nah, I think it would end with kind of a the world goes around kind of feel, like it's all in an endless cycle of the same BS. I think that's the kind of, I know that sounds morbid, but it's honest. You know, it's not a false narrative. Not that I'm saying this movie really portrayed a false narrative. I just think it would be a little more realistic.
Yeah. And I think it would probably center more on the day-to-day lives of the people who are living in this apartment complex than on kind of the ins and outs of the actual legal battle, especially because, as we talked about in the episode, Nicole Beharie's character, and we'll talk about Nicole in a second, isn't so much involved in that legal process. And so it'd be more important to see, like, what is her day-to-day life like? What, you know, Alfre Woodard's character and Exhibit's character. Let's see more of that as opposed to the more procedural elements of it in the legal system.
And we've talked about this for several movies, but it would work better as a miniseries because you would have multiple episodes to dive in. And it doesn't even need to be one season. This could be like a 3-season kind of show that covers this entire arc, because there's a lot to work with.
Yeah, in like, the vein of a When whether, They See Us or something like that. Yeah.
Yeah, even if you want to dive into what a raid is and how it really affects a community, because that's like one of the first act's main issue is how a raid affects a small community. So you could really dig into that. You could build on the Exhibit's, I don't know if it's his character's wife or girlfriend, the dynamic between them, really building tension before the raid. Because when in this movie, when the raid hits, we do not know really the tension, how deep it goes, like how far the other character, I really am blanking on her name right now, but how far she's willing to go out of spite against Dee Roberts,
right.
Nicole Beharie's character.
Right. And
a lot of stuff we could really dig into. Right. Exactly.
Yeah.
It's a little jarring when we see it in the movie that's the reason that Anthony Mackie's character was kind of like plucked by her to do such a thing. Like, why does she have this influence over people? And you and I were both let down by the climax of the courtroom drama aspect of it being off screen. So a miniseries really lets you dive in, dig in, let the Will Patton character get his own arc more so than just I'm the white guy going against the good old boys. Really build his character. It would really serve better in a miniseries or multiple season show kind of atmosphere. And I like this movie. So don't get me wrong. It could be better.
And give Lucinda Jenny more to do, too. Don't forget.
Of course.
Of course. So, yeah, Nicole Beharie. I mean, like, what a glow up over the past 14 years. Like, this was her first movie and holds it down. Like, does a phenomenal central performance. Like really shoulders this thing.
Yeah, in our mini-sode coming up, she may get a nomination for the Best Actress Award in our first grouping of movies award season. But
certainly,
look, I think it's a little unfair to say it's a career best, but it's certainly a career defining performance. It's an important film, and She has a tough accent to pull off in it, does it very well, and she is a slam dunk. This movie is not... There are many times where a film has a first-time actor or actress or performer, and they just kind of... You kind of, like, forgive them subconsciously, and you kind of say, they were good. She's really good here. Like, there, you would never know this was her first movie. You know, it's a really solid showcase, and she has worked consistently over the years for a reason.
And I think it does speak to kind of the lack of great roles for young Black women that she really didn't get a lot more to do over the years. Like, she shows up in The Express also in 2008, a movie that's close to my heart in some way because it's about Syracuse football star Ernie Davis. She's in Steve McQueen's Shame in 2011. I think that's great. The Last Fall in 2012, a movie I wasn't familiar with, but happens to be from Matthew A. Cherry, who would go on to win an Oscar for the animated short Hair Love. In 2013, she's opposite Chadwick Boseman in 42, playing Jackie Robinson's wife. Like, a lot of supporting roles, and I'm like...
Yeah, and the 42 role is not a great showcase for her, because it is the concerned wife role.
Yes.
And that movie itself has a lot of problems. So it's not the best, but I'm glad she's working, because Sleepy Hollow, there's where, you know, she got a chance to shine. And that was a fun show. So...
Yeah, she gets that network money, that series regular network money. That's great. And then she goes on to do an indie Monsters and Men with John David Washington, which is great. And then notably, most notably, last year, finally has another big starring role in Miss Juneteenth, which for all the reasons that we talked about on the American Violet episode and on other episodes as well, like, a very important movie to have come out in 2020.
And you know, I know we're just literally listing her filmography at this point, but Striking Vipers is a top three Black Mirror episode for me.
Okay.
And she's really good in it. So
very good.
Yeah, it's very a lot good. Of stuff. I've always wanted to see Monsterland. And I know Jacob's Ladder, which I'm a fan of the original. I heard that this was just like a bad remake. So collect that paycheck, Nicole. Do your thing, because you're really good at your job.
Yeah. And now to get to the movie that I said we were going to drop on 420, American Ultra, which pretty okay. Not terrible, definitely not a stoner movie, but also no. Features an actor that's very high on your list of favorites.
Yeah, Walton Goggins, who I will tell you that my Walt Goggins fandom started in 1997. So that's how far back I go with Mr. Goggins, because he was the young hotshot ball player in Major League 3 back to the minors as Billy Downtown Anderson. So I was a Walt Goggins stan since 1997, when I was 9 years old. So that's how far back I go with Walt Goggins. And I, over the last 10 years or so, he's really, really become a part of the pop culture renaissance that is the Danny McBride, Quentin Tarantino's. Like, he's really been a major player in those guys' pieces, and David Gordon Green. And there's a lot to like there. He's a great character actor.
Also shows up as the villain in Tomb Raider, the most recent Tomb Raider with Alicia Vikander.
He's the villain? I thought he was the dad. I've never seen it.
No, the dad is the guy from The Wire. Can't think of his name.
Dominic West?
Yes. Who I think, I haven't seen the film, but I think he only shows up on like a camcorder, like a recording. So yeah, I forgot to introduce that segment was called Wall to Walt.
Oh! I'm Gaga for Goggins.
There you go. That would have been better. I like that better. So Gaga for Goggins. So, like, give me your do you have a top five for me?
Ooh, a top five Walt Goggins. Well, he's really good in Vice Principals. He's fun in Righteous Gemstones. Again, these are like McBride, so they know how to use him just like spot on. Hateful Eight, his first real leading man performance, albeit not credited as such. Him and Sam Jackson are really the like keys of that film, and he gets a chance to shine. You know, he's older, but in that movie he felt like he was 20 years old. Like, it's just such subtle range. I mentioned Major League 3. He's also great as Billy Crash in Django Unchained. Like, he's so likable and could be so hateable with only in that Christoph Waltz vein of just the slightest tweaks. So I'm a big Walt Goggins fan, and Walt Goggins shows up in a movie I was so pumped for, and it let me down. Straw Dogs remake. with, I think it's James Marsden.
And
Kate Bosworth.
Yes.
And he comes in as, what's the actor's name from?
Oh,
Dominic.
Yeah.
He's like his older brother.
Sure,
in
sure.
Straw Dogs. So I'm just a big Goggins fan. He is somebody that I go out of my way to watch.
Yeah, I never saw The Shield. Did you ever watch The Shield?
The Shield? The only reason I haven't seen The Shield, even though it has Walt Goggins, same with Justified, which has Walt Goggins, is because it's quite an investment of my time right now. And because I hadn't yet seen them, I'm just like so far behind. I just can't see how I would do that right now. But from all accounts, like, he shines in both shows. So, you know, I can't speak to those. All, obviously, they put him on the map with a lot of people, but I was a fan of his before these things, and I just happen not. Shows are a lot harder to watch consistently. Like the HBO shows, they're very easy to watch. So
yeah.
Something like Justified and S.H.I.E.L.D. would be quite an investment. Maybe one day I will pick them up just because he's in them.
Yeah, I think also The S.H.I.E.L.D. started when we were still pretty young in our early teens. Like, that's not a show that I was going to seek out.
Correct. By the way, Walt Goggins, he was the lead in The Unicorn, which a lot of people loved. And it's not your typical Walt. He played like the dreamboat guy for like women in their 30s and 40s. And, you know, what a testament to his range where he could pull that off believably. So I watched a few episodes and he's great. He's a delight.
Oh,
so.
Oh, also, speaking of The Unicorn, shout out to Michaela Watkins, who... I met once at a show, a stand-up show called Peacock in LA that I used to go to pretty much every Thursday, hosted by my friend Kieran Deal. But I met her there. I had also watched her show Casual, and she also happens to be a Syracuse native.
Wow.
So how about
that? Did she go to Syracuse University?
I don't think she did.
Real quick, big Marvel fan that I am, Walt Goggins is also in Ant-Man and the Wasp, albeit a forgettable role. It's not really his fault. It's just that they kind of shoehorned an extra villain in there, and that's where he comes in. But always love him, always when he shows up. And in American Ultra, I really like his performance, and I feel sympathy for his character, and I think he's a victim of his circumstance. So I'm a big fan of that performance as well.
Yeah, Ant-Man and the Wasp, one of the more forgettable Marvel movies, I think, even not just his role within it.
It has its fans. I think it's kind of middle towards back of the pack of the MCU movies. So
when basically an entire movie is just meant to set up like why Ant-Man was where he was when Endgame starts, I'm like, why we needed a 2-hour movie to do this, you know?
Yeah. What it has going for it is the charm of the characters. Obviously, Paul Rudd, Michael Pena, T.I., the guy who's going to be in Suicide Squad. I forget his name. Like, they're all so likable. But real quick, to put a final touch, a period at the end of the sentence for Walt Goggins, who shows up in one of your favorite movies, Bourne Identity. I remember that...
I do not remember him in Bourne Identity, and I feel like I might have rewatched that relatively recently. Guess I have
he
to watch it again.
He plays a research tech. He plays a research tech.
Oh, okay.
Not a big part.
I figured he had to be on like the Langley side of things, but yeah.
Sure. So, okay, Major League Back to the Minors was 98, not 97, like I said. But House of 1,000 Corpses came out in 2003. When I was a kid, a lot of my favorite actors would be in horror movies that I was too scared to see. So what I would do is go online and read the scripts to find out what happened to their character because I cared so much. One example is Thomas Ian Nicholas, Kevin from American Pie, in Halloween Resurrection, I think, where they go to the reality show. And I'm on page like 35 and he gets stabbed in the chest and pinned to a door. I'm like, don't have to read this script anymore. But House of 1,000 Corpses, I read the script. Walt Goggins plays a local deputy, and he's killed execution style. So I just want to say that a script like that gave me nightmares as a kid just reading it because I cared so much about what happened to Walt Goggins. Shout out, Walt Goggins. I love you.
And that was Gaga for Goggins.
That was Gaga for Goggins.
With Alan Austin. and, you know, we teased this on the episode about American Ultra. Not again, I'm going to say it, not a stoner movie. Just
no.
Absolutely not. I don't know where the last great stoner movie was. I know Harold and Kumar did, you know, their run of movies. The last one was very good. I mentioned in the episode, Pineapple Express is fucking brilliant. I would have loved, actually, you know who would have been great is Walt Goggins in the Kevin Corrigan role. Actually, yeah. Would have been a lot of fun. Although I do like Kevin Corrigan in that movie. But what I need to articulate, and I always said, I need to write like why this is actually an incredibly intelligent movie, because it's really easy to just write it off as a fun stoner movie, but it's actually incredibly smart and like has a really strong thematic through line. So
interesting.
So I'm going to dive into it now. You're going to get not my full thoughts, because I haven't actually rewatched it to really like notate or do the research on like how this ties back into, you know, like Reefer Madness and like things like that. You know what I mean?
Right.
Starts with an incredible sequence about the military / government running human experiments with marijuana in an underground lab, taking it all very seriously. Meanwhile, Bill Hader is having an absolute blast, cracking jokes, singing, being vulgar. Like,
Private Miller, answer the question.
What was the question again, sir?
When you think of your superiors, what emotions do you feel?
You know what problem I have with your fucking little dog and pony act you call the military? Here it is. One, lots of dudes.
Where are the boobies? Two.
Why are we underground right now, sir? Why can't we be out in the open? Why aren't we in a square right now? Why aren't we talking to people, letting them know Item 9 exists? Get it out. Shout at the rooftops. This is great. This is the bee's knees, Item 9.
Private, we need you to be serious.
I'm serious.
Your dick, my mouth.
That's inappropriate.
Fuck you.
I've seen enough. Shut it down.
A great opening sequence just for fun, but actually sets up where the third act of the film takes place. And really, it frames the movie in this way of actually upending the whole idea that weed is dangerous. You know, we're introduced to Seth Rogen, who has a high school girlfriend, and the idea of like preying on the youth is wrapped up in, you know, all the fear mongering around drugs. Right. But he's actually completely harmless and like completely intimidated by like meeting her parents or meeting the jock at school, and plus like she doesn't even really smoke weed, which he says in the movie, parodies the idea that drug users are duplicitous by having Seth Rogen pretend to be different characters as a process server, a job that's working within the confines of the legitimate legal system. I think that is like a really interesting note. Also parodies the dangerous drug dealer with James Franco in his finest performance, I think, as goofy and lovable and like entirely loving, especially to his grandmother. Like he just wants to sit back and like listen to like surround sound music on his stereo and like listen to sitcoms. And watch old sitcoms and like hilarious, you know?
Golden Globe nominated.
Golden Globe nominated, man. Yeah, great, great. Meanwhile, in the movie, it's all the authority figures who are taking it so seriously and causing the mayhem that ropes in these two characters, you know, and Danny McBride as their like hapless middleman, the cops and the lead supplier and the quote unquote Asians. I think that's just the Asians. Like it's always the Asians. It's not specific to any one nationality or anything. They're the ones engaged in the turf battle. None of this would have happened if Gary Cole hadn't killed that guy, you know? So what's most likely to happen if you smoke a little weed? You end up at Denny's, which is exactly where the three of them end up at the end of the movie, just joking about all the crazy shit they got into. And although, you know, all the injuries that Danny McBride goes through are like played up for laughs, but he's actually fine. You know, like it's kind of that absurdist thing that like no matter what, you actually will be okay if you try weed. Like this, none of this shit is actually going to happen. The worst that's going to happen is you end up at Denny's at 3 a.m. You know,
It's a brilliant point, the way you've articulated it here now. Interesting. What a deep dive.
Yeah.
Is that an original kind of theory?
I've never read it anywhere else. I wanted to, in 2018, like, set aside time to, like, do kind of a 10-year anniversary, like, espouse all my thoughts and, like, maybe, like, submit it to, like, you know, some sort of online, you know, thought catalog or whatever it is, you know, like a think piece. But I never did. But those are my thoughts. And yeah, I'm just like, you should give this another watch and think about it with that mindset of like, there's actually something deeper going on here. I think that's why I like the movie so much, because if it was just a funny stoner movie, I wouldn't love it so much.
Yeah. To me, a stoner movie, really, like, when I was coming up, the one that people my age really connected with was How High, with Method Man and Redman. Like, that was, like, the stoner movie when I was in high school that people looked back and quoted. Because I think it came out in, like, 01, and we were probably a little too young to watch it, but I think a lot of kids, like, older siblings introduced them to How High. Like, I think of that as, like, the first stoner movie that really, like... Because I was not a Dazed and Confused kid. Like, I didn't see that till I was older. I never really watched Fast Times at Ridgemont High until I was older. So, How High? But in terms of American Ultra, what would have made it a stoner action spy thriller would be if some weed was laced with something that gave him, like, the fighting abilities. Then I think you could call American Ultra a stoner movie. Because as it is now, he's just a guy who smokes weed, and that's for the first 15 minutes. Then that's it. Like, there's no weed really as part of the story. So it's not a stoner movie.
Right.
The marketing, as you said, at Comic-Con and whatever, truly false advertising.
I think I tweeted out the poster of this, like the one sheet, and it's all like very psychedelic, and Kristen Stewart and Jesse Eisenberg, there's like a bunch of smoke in the air and like bongs around. And I'm like, it's just not the movie. I think you're right. That would have been like, an interesting direction to take it in if like weed gave them superpowers.
Right.
You know, anything else you wanted to mention about American Ultra? Did you want to talk about how jacked John Leguizamo is like I did?
Was he jacked or did he have like dad bod? I don't even remember.
He was like tatted up and, you know, muscular. I wouldn't say he had anything more than he didn't have a six pack, but it wasn't a pot belly by any means.
All right. Well, I love Johnny Legs. So any mention of him, I'm happy to contribute to. So, yeah, what a rocking bod that Johnny Leguizamo had.
Johnny Legs. I'm thinking, does he have great legs? I don't know.
Johnny Legs should meet Joey Pants.
Actually, that wouldn't be bad. Yeah, I wouldn't mind seeing them in a movie together. Have they been in something together? I always like when either of them shows up in a supporting role, I'm like, this is going to be great. Like, I would have loved to see John Leguizamo in the Joey Pants role in Memento. Wouldn't that have been cool? Like, I could totally see that.
Hard to replace Joey Pants, but yes.
That is a wrap on this this minisode. Thank you so much for listening. If you like what we're doing, please give us a rating, leave a positive review. You can give us your unfiltered opinion on Twitter at AmericanScene_. And if you'd like to follow either of your patriotic co-hosts, I'm Ben Rosen on Twitter at NotThatBenRosen.
I'm Alan Austin at Alan_Austin_.
And we'll see you next time.